Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's another episode of the Husky Fan Podcast. With me, as always, my co-host, Big JC. How's it going, brother?
You know, buddy, it's going good. We interrupt this podcast to discuss COVID-19 and the vaccine and wokeism. What do you say? Alex Jones will be on in five. No, I'm kidding.
Our audience would probably skyrocket.
That's true. We could probably get Alex on the show. Let me work on that. Next episode.
Yeah. So, yeah, aside from that, brother, how are you? And are you doing just a bit better that you get to talk to me and hear my voice?
Oh, yeah. To just lift my spirits. It's a Monday. And so, you know, Mondays, everyone's got the case of the Mondays, just a little bit. But, yeah, when we can talk to the Chester, it makes everything a little better.
I mean, even you got a case of the Mondays even this time of year?
The case of the Mondays every Monday, buddy.
Well, fucking A, man.
Yeah. What can I say?
Well, what can we talk about to brighten your spirits?
Oh, well, geez, we could talk about NIL. We could talk about NIL. That's one of my favorite topics. It is an interesting topic.
Yeah, we're not going to talk about the death of college football today, but I know you probably have a few thoughts on that you want to share.
Well, I mean, I think it was inevitable, right? At some point, I don't know that we would see Barstool like basically just signing every kid, every athlete in the country to Barstool Sports, but really, it's going to be like the girls that really. You know, there'll be a few quarterbacks, and then it'll be like gymnasts, girls, there'll be, you know, some softball girls. But the girls are really going to capitalize on this, right? Because they're just going to go onto Instagram and post their ass. And someone's going to pay them $50,000 to, you know, wear a t-shirt that's, you know, barely above it. And so
OnlyFans, you know, too?
Yeah, and they'll probably parlay an OnlyFans career where they'll make, you know, 150, 200 grand a year, just making bids. I will not continue making a serious slant on this because, look, the thing about NIL is that, you know, it's not enough that, and we've had this argument before, but let's face it, the cost of going to college is obscene. The degrees now are basically worthless, but still, a lot of these athletes are getting now in the realm of, you know, $250,000 of education and exposure, and they're going to meet people, they're going to create networks. And I get the gripe, right? There are other people making millions and millions of dollars. It's kind of the way it's been for a long time. You know, when you're younger, you got to pay your dues. And if you can navigate life to earn, you know, $5 million, $10 million, $20 million a year, you know, good for you. I guess, like, where do we draw the line to where, I mean, the athletes get stipends, too. I mean, they can pay. And now, granted, I know, like, if you live in Seattle, going to UW, like, just getting a one-bedroom apartment, like what?
Yeah, the stipend is not helping anymore.
Not going to cover it, right?
For sure, the stipend has not been keeping up with rent and housing inflation.
No. But the point, like, where do we draw? I mean, training table now, I believe, is year-round. And look, there's plenty of arguments for this. But here's the other thing, too. Only a few players are really going to benefit, right? I mean, if you're just a, you know, an average run-of-the-mill player, like maybe you get creative and you find a way to profit off it. I don't know. But, you know, I think Spencer Rattler, is that the Oklahoma quarterback, I believe. I mean, he's penciled in to potentially make $1 million right out of the gate. And it's just going to be a very interesting hierarchy that's going to be created within these teams where, you know, there's going to be a select few of players that are going to be making a shit ton of money.
Yeah, and that's what Charles Barkley said. He made the same point. And oh, I just, like, I wonder, like, Oregon, for example, like, Thibodeau getting his own NFT or whatever the hell it is from Nike. I mean, how do you think that impacts, how will that impact the rest of the team when, like, one guy is getting a shit ton of benefits and, you know, most people are not? I just, yeah, I wonder how that impacts the team dynamics.
Where does that snowball into, like? You know, maybe that guy doesn't want to practice and maybe he gets treated differently, you know, in training table, or maybe they start getting their own section of the locker room. And here's the other thing that we know, Chess, is that UW will not capitalize on this for recruiting, because, you know, this is going to become a recruiting tool for the top talent. And they're going to create programs, and they're going to do pitches, and they're going to lay out a whole program of how to profit off their name and their image.
Yeah, I know that you know, people are saying, "Oh, we have Amazon here," but I was talking with Metric Superiority guy about this, and it's like, do you think Amazon really needs anyone from Husky football to, like, help their business? Like, fuck no.
No, dude. The last place Amazon is recruiting is the Husky football team, or for any sports team for that matter, in the UW athletic department. That makes no sense. Yeah, okay, you got Microsoft, you got Nintendo. I just don't know how they're not going to be coming to the football program looking for talent.
Yeah, they're not an apparel company like Nike is.
Do you know where a lot of these companies are looking for talent is in other countries. They're not even looking for talent in America.
Yeah.
I mean, let's get real. So, I mean, the thoughts are on it. I mean, it was going this direction. I mean, there was discussions around paying players. I mean, now when you compare it, I mean, a lot of players are going to be left out of this. And, you know, that you're going to create some fissures within teams and, you know, what, and then think about the guy that makes that money. Are they going to feel pressure to pay for things for other players, or, you know, throw parties and pay for the beer or whatever? You know what I mean?
Probably. I mean, if they're a good teammate, that's what they'll be doing. You know, the quarterback has to take care of his offensive line. So,
yeah, but someone's always going to feel like they got
left out. Yeah.
You know, there's always going to be someone that felt like they were treated unfairly. Even though, again, they have a full ride to this university, you know, they get tons of clothes and shoes. And then granted, like, I mean, that doesn't help you pay the rent or food. But, I mean, I'm just saying, like, you go to a bowl game, you only have to win 6 games to go to a shitty bowl, and you get a bunch of shit. I guess, where do you draw the line on all this? Like, because after this, there's going to be – people are going to want more. This isn't going to be enough. After a few years of this,
right,
this will not be enough.
Well, it's basically like the minor league of the NFL.
That's right.
That's what it will become.
Absolutely. And are we going to have the Twitter handle on back of the jerseys? I mean, what is going to be on the uniform with their NIL program, right? I mean, some school is going to create some sort of, you know, they're going to put their face on the thigh pad or something. I mean, I don't like the way it's heading.
Go ahead. I'm sorry to cut you off.
You know, I'm the guy, you know, get off my lawn guy. That's fine.
No, I think there's a lot of people who feel, I think most people feel that way, to be honest. I mean, to me, and to, you know, to segue, before we get to the main topic at hand, you know, one quick segue to this conference expansion. I mean, even before this news came out about the SEC looking to add Texas and Oklahoma, even before that, my thought was 12-team playoff, the SEC is basically, it's just NFL light. And now that you add Oklahoma and Texas to that,
yep.
I mean, you're going to have like 6 SEC teams making the playoff, like almost every year. You know, who knows, maybe there could be a year where they get 7 in. If you have, you know, a 16-team conference with all those brands, I mean, it's basically, the SEC it's basically the NFL. I mean, there's going to be, you know, like the regular season games will be meaningless. They won't mean anything because the best six or seven of those teams will get into the 12-team playoff, and that's basically all that matters. I mean, it's totally destroying college football. What made college football great, it's the history, the tradition, the regionalization, the fact that every regular season game matters. And now, I mean, some of these people on Twitter with these arguments, well, it's going to make the end of the season more exciting. There's more teams that can get in. Like, bullshit. Like, look at the NFL. Is it really exciting if, like, a 9-6 team, well, if they win, they could get into the playoffs. Like, nobody gives a shit because they're not going to win anything. They're just going to lose to the better teams as soon as they get in there. I mean, it's destroying the sport, and it's just, I mean, it's changing so rapidly just in the last 5 years, moving forward, you know, over the next 10 or 15 years. It's going to be completely different than what it looked like. And honestly, Jimmy, it's the playoff has caused all this. That's what people don't realize. The playoff has caused all these problems of, you know, one region dominating, and now all the recruits, all the best recruits, you know, want to only to go to the, you know, the same blue blood programs. That's all created by the playoff. And now they think, oh, well, we need to expand it, and, you know, that'll give more teams a chance. It's like, no, you're the answer is contraction, not expansion. And by the way, in this new system, what happens to the Pac-12 is, like, being a weaker conference, okay, you know, more Pac-12 teams will get into the playoff, but they'll have even less of a chance to win the national championship, you know, because you get into a 12-team playoff, then it's like, okay, well, you have to beat LSU, and then if you win that game, you have to beat Clemson, and then, yeah, I mean, with four teams, if it just stays at four, I mean, the Pac-12 of these other conferences should vote no on expansion. That's the only way to basically blunt the power of the South.
And who's going to get all the coverage from ESPN? I mean, they're going to cover, like you said, they're going to cover NFL Light. I mean, that's where all the talent's going to be. And those are where the games are going to be that people want to watch. And
here's the only way I'd like it, if it's NFL Light. So you have the four super conferences where the Big Ten is one, the Pac-12 is one. The Big Ten and the Pac-12 just become like the North versus the South, and the Rose Bowl is basically like the North Conference championship game, and the winner of that plays the winner of the South. I mean, that's the only way I'd be okay with this new system. Like, at least the Rose Bowl, you're still like, it still matters. I mean, it still has some historical relevance. It's still connected to the, you know, the Pac-10 and the Big Ten. That's the only, I mean, that's not going to happen, but that's, if they want to turn it into the NFL Light, that's the only way I'd be okay with it.
How many programs just get axed? How many programs are just over?
A lot. I mean, a lot are going to go the way of, like, G5s, basically, if they're lucky.
And most of them are in the red. I mean, most of these programs are not profitable. It's only going to get harder. And, you know, they can make money in bowl games, I think, right? They can make a little bit, but You have the playoff games, right? You're not going to get all the swag. Like, you know, you're just going to go play the game. Then you're going to get ready for the next one, and you're out. I mean, like, with the 12 teams, the bottom six are not going to be competitive. Okay, you might get a team that upsets a game. Like, and that's going to be so exciting. I get it.
It's going to happen, like, the first year, and then people are going to be like, see how exciting that was?
Well, and here's, like you said, about the playoff ruining everything. Like, remember when it first started? I mean, like, week three of the season, you know, the talking heads.
Who's in? Who's in?
You know, like, oh, they've just put themselves out of the playoff. It's over for them. So-and-so's in the driver's seat now. Like, okay, I don't give a shit. Week three, who you think is out and who might be in and who's the driver. I mean, let's get through like 6 weeks of football. I get it, right? That's the only focal point. You're looking at the top teams. You're going to talk about it. But my God, I mean, seriously, like one game and it's like everyone just says you're out. And you don't even let it play out. I mean, like, let it play out. And so, I mean, I guess in the sense that you get more teams in the playoff, you're going to let it play out. But you're just those. Like, I think Dabo even said, like, you know, you have the top four best teams, and it's generally clear, right? And there's a drop off. Okay, there might be one or two teams that have an argument, but beyond that, like, those teams are not going to be competitive.
Yeah, they're real. You could, and here's the thing. Go back. I mean, if you had a playoff in the 2000s, that decade, USC would have been in the playoff every single year. You know, they would have won the playoff in 2002. They would have, you know, they would be doing like 95% of what like Saban has done at Alabama. Go to the 90s, Florida State and Nebraska. That would have been the, yeah, from like 1993 to 1999. Like that would have been, those two teams would have played like every year in the playoff, if not the actual, you know, championship game. So it's like every era is dominated by, yes, like a handful of teams, and you get into, you know, where a couple schools completely dominate. I mean, it's, that's just the way it is. And just with the playoff, I mean, not to get way off track, but look what's happening in the business world. You know, just the biggest companies, they have all the power, everything's flowing to the top. It's all about making money, you know, more money, more money. Yeah. That same trend is permeated college football, unfortunately. And so the quality of the whole thing is, you know, for everybody else, is going down. It's going down, and it's going to get even worse, you know, in the next 10 years.
Yeah, Peterson saw the writing on the wall, right? And he probably
uncanny, amazing timing.
I mean, he knew what was coming. He knew he's already not liking it. He didn't like the recruiting process, especially at a bigger school. He had a better message at Boise State, a message that he believed in, and then it resonated with those kids. But, you know, when he started to go up the ladder and go to a program where, you know, the expectations was a national championship, which was possible as well, right? He knew he had all the resources to do those things. But, I mean, he saw what you had to do, and he knew it was only going to get worse, and he probably knew nil was coming down the line. I mean, yeah, his timing was perfect because he would have retired, right? If he had stayed another year or two and this came through, you'd have been done.
But let's think about this for a second, which is interesting. Okay, if nil was still like 3 or 4 years away, and all this other stuff, expanding the playoff, if that was like 3 or 4 years away, and Peterson just, you know, before he decided to retire, maybe just thought, yeah, you know, I'll just tough it out for like another year, you know, and see what happens. I owe it to these guys after this shitty 2019. The COVID year would have been perfect for him. You know, a whole year of life coaching,
yeah,
you know,
seriously.
No 12 games, you know, no 12 game schedule. No, we're not taking it that seriously on the West Coast. You know, no media to deal with, you know, no fans. It would have just been him, life coaching the play. I mean, built for life. Oh, it would have been fucking perfect. That year, it would have recharged him. It would have been okay, you know. And at this point, he'd be like, "Okay, I'm ready to go. Yeah, I got a couple years left in me. I know I don't like these other things, but I'll just coach. I'll just, you know, coach a couple more years." That, I mean, you know, that, because if it went down that path, you know, 10 years from now, we'd hear like, "Yeah, well, he thought he was going to retire in 2019, but he decided to tough it out, and then COVID gave him a rebirth that he needed." So,
He didn't want to – he wasn't even excited about the Rose Bowl. I mean
– yeah, no, good point. That's yeah, sad.
That's to think about. That's, you know, possible. Yeah, but he, you know, he did not enjoy the Rose Bowl, which, you know, blows my mind, but everyone's mind, right?
Yeah, that's really sad.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean – back to him making that choice, it was the right one, especially for him, because his message wasn't probably being heard. And the reports we heard about, you know, his communication with the players, that's not who he was. And clearly it was time to end.
Yeah, he was just – he was totally off the 2019 season. We don't need to rehash it, but
– yeah. Well, we've been over it many times. So, well, we'll see how it shakes out. I mean, we're still going to watch, but I'm not going to lie. I'll tell you this. I feel lucky and I feel blessed that I was able to, you know, enjoy Husky football through the 90s, even though the 2000s were a shit show and the dark ages, except for a couple years. I still feel like I got to see, you know, some of the purity of college football, so to speak, and a fan base that really cared, because that territory and that history is probably never going to return in any way.
Yeah, I mean, at least the young dudes out there, I mean, they got to experience 2016. You know, they got to experience a Rose Bowl. I know it wasn't that great.
And a playoff berth.
Yeah. I mean, they got to experience, so I'm at least happy for the young dudes out there that they can hold on to that. But, I think, you know, we have probably 2 years. If you look at the talent on our team, like, you know, we're going to be really competitive this year and the following year. But, you know, after that, then you go to the 12-team thing. You know, Oregon's really out-recruiting us right now. And so I'm just, you know, going to enjoy the next 2 years. I'm going to, on the side, I'm going to work like heck to get the school to recognize the 1984 team. I feel like that's one of my callings as a fan.
Well, we'll be excited to touch on that in the future, buddy.
Yeah, I'll discuss it in the future. But, yeah, no, I've talked to some people and the work on that has begun, but I feel like, you know, so 3 years from now would be the 40th anniversary. So we'll see, but I don't know how long it took them to get 1960, but yeah, we'll talk about that in the future. But I mean, do you want to any more thoughts, or do you want to move on to recapping some glorious history?
Yeah, let's, we can do the recap and we'll go from there, buddy.
Yeah. So, I put together, if you're listening, you'll see this post, right? I mean, if you're listening, like, right after we recorded this, I haven't posted this yet on bowdowntowashington.com, but I have a long post, the top five home games of the last 100 years at Husky Stadium. So I think last year was technically the 100th year, but I don't know if they count 2012, because that was at Seahawks Stadium. And then last year there wasn't fans, so, you know, whatever. I'm just calling this the 100th season. Top five home games of the, do you want to just let me, I'm going to go through some games that didn't make the top five. I'll get your comments.
Yeah.
So one I have on there is the Nebraska game, 1997. Now this was actually, I believe, number three against number six. So this was like a major top 10 matchup. I mean, for the younger dudes out there, 1997, probably the most disappointing year in Husky history, honestly.
Yes.
This was a preseason national championship contender.
Yeah.
And they had some injuries.
It.
Yeah, they had they were loaded. I mean, they had something like they had the most draft picks out of anybody in the next draft, to just tell you what a disappointing season it was. But this game, so we lost to Nebraska. I think it was 27-14. They raced out to a 21-0 lead. They injured Brock Heward early in the game. And Marcus Tuiasosopo, as a true freshman, came in and rallied the team back. Now, they were down in the third quarter, 21-14. And then Lambeau decided to, you know, we'd been stopping him with that. He decided to do an onside kick. And that kind of, like, lost. We had the momentum. And that kind of lost it. But, you know, watching this game, Jimmy, Lynn Swan was on the sideline. He said the decibel reading hit 119 when the team came out of the tunnel. So if you watch the beginning of it, you can see how loud it was. And then if you watch, like, our touchdowns and our good plays, the crowd is, like, totally into it. And, I mean, it's a shame that...
Oh, I was there. I remember.
Oh, you were, well, yeah, tell me about it.
Well, I mean, it was insane, right? There was so much hype and excitement for the matchup, and then Tui just battling in that game. It was just, you know, it was obviously a tough pill to swallow, because, you know, of course, nobody comes into Husky Stadium and beats Washington, right? I mean, and we knew the talent and the the opportunity this team had that season. So obviously, you know, it was a tough loss. It was a hell of a game, but I took it really hard, man. Real emotional about it. Didn't take it so well. And I think Brock was thrown off his back foot early in that game too. He wasn't his best early on in that game either. And then, but Tui was just like, holy shit. I mean, obviously it was a long time ago now, but yeah, it was an unbelievable game. I used to go crazy in the stands. I was a nut job. People thought I was nuts, but I didn't care. There was a handful of us that really were into it in our area, but there was a lot of people that thought I was nuts.
At what age did you stop being a nut job?
That's a good question. I probably settled down in my early 30s. All the time before that, I was in that job.
For me, I'd probably say like mid to late 30s.
Yeah, or, no, I mean, I'd still get into it in my early 30s, but I was starting to tone it down. And plus, the crowd was getting shittier, too. Yeah. There was a slow death. Obviously, it didn't help that, you know, there was a lot of shitty seasons, you know, after the Rose Bowl. But, yeah, you know, later into the year, you know, it just wasn't the same. The passion was lessening.
I remember, I think it was at the 2000 Arizona game when I think it was the after the Curtis Williams game. And yeah. it looked like, you know, we needed like a comeback. It looked like we were going to lose. And there was like, I just remember I saw some guy who was like going crazy about like, you know, he's like, oh, they were holding Jeremiah Farms. Like, they didn't call it. And, like, the wife had to, like, calm him down. And I was like, that's my future. Like, that's, yeah. You know, that's going to be me in, like, 15 or 20 years.
Well, you know what turned the team around in that game was Greg Carruthers just lit somebody up.
That was the Willie Hurst flip game. Did he have one flip or two?
It was one. Unbelievable. Yeah, I can still picture it now. But yeah, Greg Carruthers kind of woke up the team. He just lit a guy up, just lit him up. And, you know, that kind of changed the tone of that game. But I do remember it was tentative, obviously, after that. The team was very tentative. But I will say, you know, where you felt that some of the magic come back was the LSU game, Sark's first game against LSU.
I gotta throw that in my list, actually.
Yeah, that even though that was a loss, it was still a good game. The crowd was insane. I remember the coaches were, you know, they were super hyped up, right? I mean, before we knew, like, Nansen was a real shithead and all that stuff. If I recall, he was, like, really jacked on the sidelines and a few other guys. Like the, and that's what the team needed, right? They needed – and I think – I will give Sark credit on that. Like, I think those coaches came in, they knew they had to change the culture and the attitude, and, you know, they did that visibly. Were doing that. You could see that they were working with these guys to change their mindset because it was so bad.
No, I think in 2009 they got like everything out of that team, and they were 5-7, but they had like I think a 1-point loss to UCLA on the road, and then that Notre Dame loss was just, I mean, that, you know, where like Chris Polk scored and somehow they like said it was, I mean, the officials at Notre, I mean, that's really.
That was a great game though.
Yeah. I mean, it was really a great, like Chris Polk was just running all over them. Like we took control in the second half and that was just, that was a crime against college football. What happened? It's fucking officials.
Yeah. Oh, it was insane. Absolutely insane.
Chris Polk is like halfway in the end zone. They don't call it a touchdown.
Unbelievable.
Good Lord.
Yeah, I that one still pisses me off. Thanks for bringing that up. Blood pressure's rising now.
Okay, but speaking of two, all right, let's get to the next game. Not on our list, but the USC game 2009.
Yeah. Yeah, again, I mean, you know, an attitude changer for the team and a crowd pleaser. I remember that game vividly being there. And after the game was, I probably stood in the stands. I was probably in the stands for at least 20, 25 minutes.
Just taking it all in?
Taking it all in. And my dad was actually in the hospital. And, you know, we'd always go to the games together. And, you know, he had to watch it from the hospital bed. He wasn't too pleased. But, yeah, I remember that was a hell of a day.
Wait, he wasn't too pleased?
Well, that he couldn't go to the game. No, that he couldn't be in attendance, sorry.
Was he reacting like the coach in Major League when he was in the hospital, you know, during the playoff run?
I think, you know, he had to keep his motions at keel. I doubt he did a good job, but and the way they won it with that drive, that was an epic drive at the end. Holy shit. I mean, give Locker credit.
Okay, let me just cut. All right, 10-second timeout. So watching a Husky game from your hospital bed and getting riled up, how many of us is that going to happen to at some point? It's probably every male listening to this.
Maybe we end up, you know, maybe that's where we end up. We just croak on the bed from a Husky game. It could be. Could be in our future.
But, you know, you're right about Locker. Like that, because I think they got sacked, like, the first play of that drive.
Yeah, he did.
He got sacked, and... Yeah, no,
he for a long pass, I believe, I think in the middle of the field. It's like a 15 or 17-yard gain, somewhere in that realm. Perfect pass. Thread the needle. Probably Locker's best pass of his career.
Yeah, and Locker, I mean, just two observations. Like, one, he was really clutch. Like, Sark won a lot of close games, and Locker was really clutch.
Oh, for sure.
And, yeah, it just, that's like...
Let's not erase too much of the history. Holiday Bowl. Actually, no, he was good in the Holiday
Bowl. He had a lot of rushing yards.
Regular season game.
Yeah, and it's just a shame that, like, he couldn't play for, like, a better team, you know, that just because we mismanaged the program. Because, not taking anything away from, you know, Jake Browning, but, like, I mean, if Locker was the quarterback on the 2016 team, I mean, he just, like, the attitude of that team, like, the physicality, the old school, like, the swag that they played with, and... You know, you throw like Locker on that team, it just would have been fucking perfect.
Remember when he came out against Syracuse his first game? You're just like, holy shit, dude! This guy can run. This guy is electric.
Yeah, and Sark, the quarterback and offensive genius, didn't really improve him from him being a freshman onto him being a senior.
Yep. No, it's well documented that Sark. He's had little success with quarterbacks.
Yeah.
So, at our pace, getting through these games, we're going to be here all night.
All right, we'll move a little faster. Okay, Ohio State 1986. Okay, so this was a season opener. It was a top 20 matchup. Ohio State, they finished 10-3 that season and number 7 in the AP poll. We finished 8-3-1, and I think number 18, but number 7 in SRS. So that game, two really good teams, first game of the season, Washington 40, Ohio State 7. I mean, that's one of the biggest. Can you imagine that today?
Oh, shit.
I mean, we probably can't even imagine beating Ohio State, let alone, like, blowing them out like that.
No. What was it, 03 when Reggie Williams and that team went to Columbus and just got slaughtered? I went to that. I went to that too.
Me and Metric Superiority guy, we were young Dukes getting a real baptism.
That was just a bloodbath. I think every road game we went to, like, I traveled to a lot of games. I went to a lot of games in that stretch of the 2000s, and we witnessed so many bad losses. That Notre Dame destruction, Curtis Williams, the receiver, I'm blanking his name, he broke his wrist.
On their stupid stadium.
Willingham was the coach at Notre Dame that time. The Michigan 12 men on the field. that Ohio State drubbing. It was a joke.
The Ohio State drubbing, I think, was only 28-9, but it was like physical. It was a physical drubbing by them. It was much worse than the score indicated.
I think
that was the year where Hugh Millen said they look like Ohio State, Groz. Obviously, you said that before, well before that game was played.
Yep, he did.
But when
it was not even a game. It was not even close.
Yeah,
I remember the band just kept pouring. I'm like, holy shit, dude! Look at all these people. There's like 100-some thousand in that stadium, and there's like 200 band members. It's like they never stopped coming out of that tunnel.
Is that the most people you've ever seen in your life at one time?
That game, the Michigan 2000, I mean, that was like 104,000. The LSU Sark ass kicking.
You went to that one?
Zero. That was like 90,000, right? But I think they said there was close to like 120,000 at the game, but, you know, there's a large group of people that don't even – they go there, but they don't even go into the game. They just want to be out there. But, yeah, those were probably the biggest crowds.
Yeah, my last comment on that, at the Ohio State game, there was a Ohio State fan who was talking to me and Andrew, mostly to Andrew, our metric superiority guy. Okay, everybody knows what his name is. And he said, like, this is our gift to the world. Like, he was having, like, a semi-serious conversation. But that's basically what he was saying. Like, this is, you know, Ohio, like, we're, you know, and he was telling us, like, don't take shit from anybody. And it was basically pointing out, like, you know, we don't really have much here in Ohio. This place is a dump. But, like, you know, this Ohio State football, like, that's our gift to the world.
Well, I'll tell that trip, though. We ate at a great Italian restaurant. They treated us super good. They gave us, like, extra wine and great food. Walking to the stadium, we passed like a frat row, and there was probably like 60 guys on the front of the house, you know, chanting assholes to us in unison. We had, you know, there were fans wearing fuck Michigan t-shirts, like with bold letters on the shirts. And there was a guy like cussing us out on the corner waiting to cross the street. It was like, it was not the most welcoming crowd.
No, they're that's definitely they're the worst fans. Like, that's the most hostile fan base. It's even like it. Oregon's not even close to as bad as Ohio State is.
No. Yeah, 100%. Anyway, great win in 86.
Okay, so yeah,
probably has an argument for, you know, a top fiver.
Yeah, I mean, I'm also gonna do later. Hopefully in the next couple of weeks, you know, greatest performances ever. That game probably, I mean, I did a top 10 a couple of years ago, but that game's probably pretty close. Okay, next on the pre rankings, we have Boise State 2013. I take it you went to that game.
I did, and that was, I believe, UW had 540 yards of offense in that game.
That was the retake Montlake game.
Yeah.
First game of the new stadium.
Yeah.
38-6 over Boise State.
Unbelievable offensive production in that game. Definitely. That was Keith Price, if I'm recalling correctly.
Yeah, the hurry up was really working.
Huh?
The hurry up offense was really working.
Yeah, the hurry up. Yeah. I mean, they just that was impressive. I mean, the offense was clicking on all cylinders, so to speak.
Yeah, okay, next game, the 2003 Apple Cup. There are a couple people that mentioned this. I know you'll probably have a few things to say about this. This is surprising, but the 2003 Apple Cup, that's actually the largest crowd ever at Husky Stadium, that game.
Really?
Yes.
Now, again, this is the Marquise Cooper interception, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, that's one game where I went crazy. I lost my mind. I was running up the stands, running down the stands. I was hugging people. I lost my mind. Because, I mean,
I love hearing about this side of you, brother.
Yeah. Yeah, I can surprise you once in a while. And I believe Wazoo was ranked like what, 4, 3, somewhere in there.
I don't think this was 2003, not 2002. 2002, I think they were number 3.
Number 3. Well, I thought they were still pretty damn good.
Yeah, 2003, I think they were like 10-1 or 10.
Yeah,
and,
I mean they had a really good record. Maybe they weren't ranked
at that the beginning time. Of the broadcast, cuz I, you know, watched a little bit of these when I posted them. They Wazoo could have won a share of the conference championship.
That's what I thought. There was something on the line for Wazoo, yeah.
And I think this was the year where they were ahead of Oregon like 40-3 at halftime or something. It was this year. Yeah, I think this was the year they like completely destroyed Oregon. And I think this was the year they also like got way ahead of Notre Dame and they blew it. And so this was actually a good, legit, really good Coug team.
It was.
And
yeah, no, they were really good. They were good.
And our performance in the Apple Cups, like 2002, 2003, were very schizophrenic. You know, we had Neuheisel 2002, you know, Gilby 2003. Our performances
in the – was the John Anderson –
yeah,
goals.
But our performances in the rivalry games those years, I mean, it was schizophrenic because the way we played in certain conference games, we were awful. I mean, there was no consistency. It's just like, this shows you how football is all like mental and all of that. But we just, you know, like 2003, you know, we lost to Arizona, who was like horrible. They had like one win. And then I think the next week we played Cal and gave up like 750 yards or something. Yeah.
Was Phil Snow the defensive coordinator at that time?
I think so. You know, and then so then it's like, oh, we're going to lose to Wazoo, obviously. And then, you know, we played like shit, but we ended up coming back and winning the game. Even a couple weeks earlier, like the thinking was like, okay, we're playing like shit, we're going to lose to Oregon. And then we beat them 42-10. So it just those teams were so schizophrenic.
The Case Pause game.
Yeah, but you saw how like those teams underachieved by how well they played against Oregon and Wazoo.
Well, let's shout out R.I.P. to Marquise Cooper.
Yeah, very
tragic ending to his life. Very sad.
Very sad. I mean, Marquise, you know what I remember about him is he played really well as a freshman on special teams. He was on the 2000 team.
I met him. A really, really good personality, great smile. Like really, really seemed like a really good dude.
And he was a really good player. Like he was kind of like Travis Feeney. Like he started out as a safety and they moved him up.
Yeah.
And he played in the NFL for like a handful of years.
Yeah.
And, I mean, did he pass away when he was in the NFL?
Yeah. He was out on a boat with teammates. And
right.
And a squall came through, a storm that they, you know, hadn't obviously weren't prepared for. And yeah, I mean, couldn't hold on to the boat. Yeah, sad, really sad. But yeah, no, he had a really good college career and, you know, turned that into an NFL career. That was solid. I mean, that guy was a good player.
Yeah. And okay.
Play to end that game. Oh my, that was.
Do you remember Bob Rondo's call? Marquise Cooper is going in.
You know, I don't remember at this moment, but it's tucked away somewhere in my mind. Rondo had all the best calls. There'll never be another Rondo. That's for sure.
Okay, last game that didn't make our top five. I'm hoping you have a story about this one. Oregon State 2000.
To me, that's one of the best games I've ever attended and watched. I mean, that was a phenomenal game. And all the talent that was on that field, too, for that game. I mean, you got to remember, too, Oregon State was really damn good. And they kicked the shit out of Notre Dame in the Fiesta Bowl that year. I think they won 41-3. Rich Alexis was unbelievable.
Paul Arnold had a really good game
Paul Arnold, I was going to say, Paul Arnold, you know, obviously he didn't live up to his high school recruiting hype, but, I mean, he was really good in that game. You know, and then you had Hushmanzadeh and Chad Johnson. And I think you had Simonton and Patrick McCall. McCall was a really good running back. I think he played in the NFL. Was Simonton on that team? Am I getting that wrong?
Yeah. Yeah, he was on that team. We were lucky to win that game.
Yeah, we were lucky to win that game. I mean, I think they had to kick a 51-yard field goal to tie or take the lead, if I remember.
Yeah, to tie. What happened at the end of the game is so they were moving, I don't know, they were like on the 25-yard line maybe. And so they had a second and short, like a second and one. And then Larry Triplett TFL on Simonton for like a 2-yard loss. And so the clock was running down, and Jonathan Smith made a mistake and spiked it on third down. So I don't, maybe they were out of sorts there, but like they could, I don't know, there was 30 seconds left or something. The clock was run, you know, think of like the Seahawks when they were, how they were managing the clock, you know, when they blew the Super Bowl. Sorry to bring that up, but it was a similar situation where they had enough time, but like it appeared, you know, they weren't,
right.
So they didn't need to spike it. And so I think Smith kind of panicked and forgot it was third down. And so he spiked it where they had to kick, and it, you know, left them with like a fairly long field goal. But that Oregon State team, I think at the end, so Oklahoma won the national championship.
And we should have played in the title. Yeah,
Miami was the best team, you know, who we beat that year, that game's also on this list. But Oregon State, like they might have been the second or third best team in the country end of the season. Like that, what Dennis Erickson did with that team was just
unreal.
Yeah, totally unreal. And as a college football fan, you have to love it.
No, I mean that was like Tui. The guy had so much damn grit. I mean, oh my god, I was at that game too. I mean, I remember that night. I remember everything about it. I just remember being, you know, nervous, and obviously, like, there was so many good plays in that game. It was back and forth. I mean, that was just a great college football game. And like, shout out to the Oregon State fan, Beaver fans, because, I mean, they've, you know, been a shitty program. And you know, they turn out, and they wear all their chainsaw shit and their orange shirts. And, you know, I mean, whatever. A little shout out to those rascally little Beaver fans.
I remember, I think Tui had like a great like ball fake that looked like he was playing basketball. Like he was going in to score.
Deep into the end zone.
Yeah, yeah. He dove in from like the 2 or 3 yard line at the same time. He just like, you know, he faked to the right, and it looked like a move you'd see a basketball player make, and then just dove in. It's so beautiful.
No, it was phenomenal. No, I great game. Definitely close to the top five. For sure. For me, at least.
Well, it's just because there's so many. All right. So now we get to the top five. And,
yeah,
you know, there's four clear ones. But
yes.
Number five, I don't know. I'm sure you probably went to this game.
Yeah.
The 2001 Michigan game.
Phenomenal.
I mean, think about the environment. Defending Rose Bowl champs. You're playing
Pickett's debut.
But yeah. Reggie Williams' debut.
Yeah,
4 catches for 134 yards.
Yeah, that huge catch along the sideline. I think he lost his shoe on that catch as well. He may have scored had he not lost his shoe.
And that was a game where we played horribly. And then, Michigan in the fourth quarter, they're kicking like a 35-yard field goal to take a 2-score lead. And we block it. It bounces right to the fastest guy, Alexander, touchdown. And then Michigan gets the ball back. You know, they run up the middle for 2 yards. Then they throw like a swing pass. The guy bobbles it, and Omari Lowe picks it off and takes it back. And the crowd was just. And that's when Tim Brandt, the color guy, was saying, "I hope this press box is stable because it's rocking."
And you know, Omari Lowe, underrated talent, probably never got his due. And he played in the NFL, too.
He did.
That's right. Rock Alexander, I remember that. Yeah, that guy could run. That's right, yeah. Mari Lowe had the interception. But, yeah, that was a phenomenal victory. And it was payback, too, because if I'm recalling, the year before was the 12 men on the field.
The next year.
That was the next year. Sorry.
The payback for that has to be coming up. The payback for that has to be coming up in like 6 weeks.
Right.
Or seven weeks, whenever it is.
See, look at my memory. I'm like losing it all through these years, right? The next year was, and James Sims, I believe, was the 12th man on the field in that Michigan game.
Yes, but we're talking about good moments.
I thought the Nevada loss with Gilby was the top five.
The Stanford 2006 loss was probably, I think that's the worst loss I've ever seen. But yeah, the Nevada loss is up there for
sure. That was against Tormey. That was probably
the one guy on Nevada had like five sacks.
I thought like my life was over after Nevada. I seriously, like, this is the end of Husky football. It's over. I was in the dumps. That was one of the lower days of my life, was that Nevada loss.
Oh, man.
Anyway.
Yeah, yeah, that was brutal. That was brutal.
Yeah.
But anyway, sticking to happy moments. So that Michigan crowd was the third biggest crowd ever at Husky Stadium.
Well, what about where did the Notre Dame game with Ron Palace stack up? Because I remember they brought in additional bleachers to that game.
Yeah, I have to check. I got these stats from Dan Rayley, who seems to know everything about this stuff.
Okay, I'd be curious because
I
don't recall many games at Husky Stadium where they brought in additional seating.
What about that year we played Army, right? Or did we play Navy? I think it was Army. And I think that was...
It was Army.
I don't know if these numbers are right. I think Army was the most attended game.
Yeah, we should figure that out. Interesting.
Yeah, okay.
And that tells you where Husky football used to be, right? With a hot ticket, as our boy, pool boy, would like to say, a hot ticket.
You're
bringing in additional seating for a game. You can't even get a fucking stadium full.
I'll just tell you this. I would take Pool Boy back in a second.
Okay.
No, when Pool Boy and they got, you know, they made those coaching changes. They got Wilcox and Tosh Lupoi. Not only did that save Sark's career, but it laid a foundation for the 2016
blank check,
team.
Right? Blank check.
Yeah. No, Tosh said no like three times. They kept just raising it until he said yes.
Well, good. That's a good move. Yeah, give us Pool Boy back now.
And Pool Boy also hired Chris Peterson. Technically he hired Peterson, but we know that Peterson really hired himself. But then after the fact, the Husky Honks, after the 2018 championship game over Utah, I remember in the post game they were even trying to say, oh, Jen Cohen, and, you know, she played a big role in, you know, getting Chris Peterson here.
No.
Which was total bullshit.
Bullshit. False.
But anyway, moving along, because we do have to spend... Okay, last thing on Michigan 2001. What are your memories from being at that game?
I always go back to this word, electric, because that's just what it is. You felt it in the air, the crowd. I mean, those are the moments that, like, life is worth living, where, you know, you're focused on one event, there's nothing else, everyone's out of their mind, and you're having fun. You're not worrying about anything else other than that moment. And seriously, I mean, that's part of why going to the games every Saturday meant so much, because you could just, like, you tailgated, you ate food, you enjoyed your friends, you went into the game. Even though we saw a loss for most of those years of 2000, we're always pissed off at the end. It still was like a break from all the bullshit. And, those are the moments that mean the most, for those huge epic plays, tide turning plays, game turning plays, where just, you know, those are the memories you hold on to, especially now.
And now we catalog those memories at bowdowntowashington.com.
Hallelujah.
All right, so moving along.
Yeah.
I call this game, this is the millennial generation's all I saw was purple game. And that's Stanford 2016.
Yeah, rightly stated. Good analogy.
I mean, if you think of the parallels between, we'll get to that game in 1990 against USC and against Stanford. I mean, there are numerous parallels between the two. I mean, if you look at the team, the Huskies were incredibly focused for that game. The crowds for both games were incredible. And if you look at the overall performance, both were, I mean, two of the best in Husky history. You know, the stadium was absolutely on fire. The crowds were incredible. And Jimmy, 1990, that game, Washington was up 24-0 at half. Do you know what the halftime score was that 2016 game against Stanford?
Tell me.
23-0 at halftime.
Wow. Very cool.
And, you know, 1990, that really spearheaded that run. And
also think about Browning's presence in that game versus his senior year. I mean, he had swagger to him. He had confidence. Different guy. It's amazing what a season can do, or a career can do to somebody. But I do remember him just being, you know, very commanding of the team at that time.
Yeah, but I mean,
go back and watch him in that game.
Yeah, and coming into the 1990 season, you know, that I think everybody knew, like, we were a team that had a lot of hype, but people weren't sure if the team would fulfill it, and everybody knew it's like, okay, Washington, USC, you know, Washington's got to win that game if you're going to go to the Rose Bowl. It was the same thing with Stanford, so there was just. This, do you remember, just like leading into that game, I just remember, like, this is such a massive game.
Oh, yeah.
Just huge hype. In 1990.
It was a nice game, ESPN.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the first two games of 1990, like, we were unimpressive. And, you know, the same thing going into that Stanford. Like, we just almost lost to Arizona the week before. It was awful. So, it was, it was a bit of a surprise. But, anyway,
it was a drubbing. It was a great night. And that was a walk down memory lane of what a crowd at Husky Stadium could be, because that was a hell of a crowd that night. And a lot of people were into it. That was a great, great evening.
Yeah, I wish we could get that crowd to – I'm not saying we have to have that crowd for every home game every year, but it would be nice if, like, we could just have that crowd, like, you know, maybe two or three games a year.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to get that crowd against Dakota State or, you know, what have you.
Trump University.
Trump University. Yeah, no, you're not going to get won't get a crowd for that game in Seattle.
You'll get lots of protesters.
Yeah, I mean, probably. Probably get that Jesus guy down there too. Signs. That'd be quite the show. I gotta give that guy a credit. He's passionate and committed.
Yeah. So, all right. So, all right. Yeah. Moving on. So the top there. I think there's really. I mean, the top three are really. These are really the three best. I think clearly, historically, these three kind of stand alone.
Yeah.
Number three, I had Miami 2000. And, I mean, Jimmy, this is the best team we've ever beaten, I think.
Yes, that team was so stacked.
I mean, you could say, oh, maybe, you know, Minnesota 1960, but, you know, I don't think the SRS is even close to what Miami's was. But, yeah, if you're just looking at the talent on that, I mean, Ed Reed was on that team. I mean, how many... I'd have to look at the roster, but there's probably a few NFL Hall of Famers.
They had Dan Morgan at linebacker. They had like four running. They had Clinton.
Their running backs were ridiculous.
Yeah, they had Portis, and they had
Najee Davenport.
Yeah, Najee Davenport. They had Santana Moss. They also had another really good receiver. They had a really good tight end. That was that Greg Olson?
No, Jeremy Shockey. Was he on the team at that point? We'd have to check the roster, but yeah, Reggie Wayne. Do they have Reggie Wayne? Was he?
Reggie Wayne was no. Reggie Wayne was. Oh, was he on that team?
Yeah, he might have been. I have to look at the roster.
Was he? Yeah. Anyway, the team was absolutely stacked. They had four NFL running backs on that team, if I recall, because one of those guys got hurt. In that game, and another guy came out. I think it was Portis that came out and was like, started running all over the field late in the game.
Yeah.
Because they had another really good running back. And obviously Dorsey was really good. I mean, he had one loss going into that game.
But he was kind of like a Browning. He had never been pressured.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, and Von Tuer had an amazing game. Spencer Marona was out there battling those guys. I believe this was the game when Neuheitel called out every single player's talent and how that talent was going to win the game. He literally named every player and what they would contribute in the game. I mean, it was – rumor has it, like, it was one of the most epic pregame speeches ever made, because of the way he involved every player, how they were going to help the team win.
Yeah, I think I was reading a little bit about that when I was doing this research, and Larry Triplett made a comment about it, similar to what you're saying. But yeah, no, that's...
I mean, and they had the fumble. They had the fumble against Santana Moss, I think, on a kickoff.
Yeah, I think it was a punt.
You're right. It was a punt. And I was on the field for the fourth quarter of that game. And
oh, man.
It was, again, I'll go back to it. It was hair standing electric on the field in that game. I mean, it was mind blowing to be down on the field.
Were you just looking at the clock and like thinking the seconds were just like taking like minutes to tick down?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it was insane. It was insane being down there. I mean, the electricity, you're just like flowing with everyone. It was unbelievable. That was a phenomenal game. Crowd was just out of their minds. That was just a massive victory.
Yeah, I mean,
that was the most talented. I mean, the Whammy Miami team, you know, that Miami team was absolutely stacked with talent, too. But this Miami team might have had that team beat. It's close.
No, I think it's this 2000 Miami team. But yeah, these are, I mean, I'll do another post on the greatest wins in Husky history, but the two Miami games, they might be in the top three, both of them.
Yeah, no, for sure.
But yeah, I mean, so how are you able to be on the field, if I can ask?
I got a pass for that game.
so someone was able to get you a pass.
Yeah, I was able to get a pass.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah,
yeah. That entire second half, or that entire fourth quarter, was like tight butthole time.
Oh,
do you remember Tui almost blew it? Like, we were ahead. I think we had 34-21, and he threw, like, we stopped them. They went for it on fourth, and then like two plays later, like deep in our own end, he threw an interception.
Yep. Yeah, remember when he pitched the ball against Purdue in the Rose Bowl?
Yeah.
It was like one of those plays you're just like, what? Yeah, I recall.
But, yeah, there's some, you know, Miami's players. There's one of them, who an offensive tackle, who said, you know, the loudest plays I've ever played at. That includes my NFL career. This is the one thing that resonates in my mind.
Wow, great quote.
Yeah, and I threw in a picture, and it's Anthony Von Tuer, another guy, rest in peace.
Yeah,
Ken Dorsey.
Von Tuer could have been one of the most gifted corners ever to play at Washington. He dealt with a lot of demons, unfortunately.
He was amazing. I mean, he had block kicks, interceptions, sacks.
He was a really damn good football player. Really good.
And to go back to Neuheisel and that, you know, that pregame speech, or you said it the day before or whatever, the guy was an incredible motivator. I mean, he brought out the best in all these guys. And, I mean, it's just a shame he just couldn't develop anybody.
I mean, the guy was so charismatic. I mean, I got to do the coach's golf tour one year. I can't remember who he played with. It's one of the coaches. But, you know, at the end of you get to eat, and Neuheisel gives a speech. And, I mean, he had everyone, like, just eating out of his hand for, like, you know, 30 minutes, just telling his stories. And the guy was an amazing storyteller. And that was one of his, you know, true, like, you know, skills that he had. I mean, he knew how to hook a crowd, tell a great story, and make you feel like you're really involved. I mean, the dude was – I mean, he should have gone into politics. He could have been a career politician. I mean – but, you know, he got caught up in a lot of the drama, too, around surrounding the program and outside voices. It was amazing some of the things he paid attention to.
But you mean just, like, the media and that stuff?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, it was just like, why would you be worrying about these things? Very odd how much he would be entangled in some of these things that just – why would you spend a minute on any of that? So – you know.
But
no one's perfect.
As Azeem Victor's dad said that, I mean, he told us that Rick Neuheisel, do you remember that? He said Rick Neuheisel was the best in the living room that he'd ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, that's why he was a hell of a recruiter, and that's why Barba gave him $1 million, right? I mean, that was the only other coach, I think, at that time was Bob Bowden. And I think he was the fourth $1 million coach in college football at the time. It was something like that. Baba Bowden was number one. I don't remember who the other guys were. But there was less than five guys making $1 million as a coach.
Yeah.
It was a huge story. I mean, I don't really remember.
No, I recall. No, I remember. And how about him? I don't know where I heard this, but he let Jim Lambright be on the sideline for the 2000 Rose Bowl.
I do remember that.
That's a pretty unselfish, respectful thing. I mean, I wonder how Lambright would feel about that, or felt when he's actually on the sideline. But that's a super, you know, classy. It gets overused all the time. But, I mean, that was a super classy gesture from Neuheisel to do that.
And he put number 25 on the sideline, and I pissed me off when they took it off. I think it was Sark's tenure. They removed the 25 from the field, but
I remember reading about the players, like, leading up to the Rose Bowl. Like, they didn't think they were going to see Curtis Williams before the game, and he came into the locker room, and they were just, like, all shocked because they didn't expect to see him. And it was just a super emotional thing for the players.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was complete devastation. Yeah, I mean, he was on a ventilator. You know, he had to be, you know, in his wheelchair. He, you know, someone else, I believe they had they would pour or put oxygen into him when he was on the wheelchair, right? He was on a ventilator.
But to see him before playing, like, the biggest game you're going to play that point.
Yeah.
I mean, how could you describe the emotions that you're going through?
No, I mean, yeah, I couldn't. And, you know, Curtis was up in the box, too. He got to watch that game in person.
Great memories. Okay, so, yeah, we're getting away from that season. But when I did the Twitter poll over a year ago, that Miami actually came in number one.
Which is surprising to me. I'm surprised it eclipsed 90, but it probably has to do with just
the age of
time passing by. Yeah. Because I don't think people understood. I mean, that understood, like, you know, that USC era, and you know they had Marinovic and mystique around USC at the time and all those things.
Okay, so number two. So there's two left. Number two.
Yeah.
And I actually had this number one originally, but I changed it. Nebraska 1992.
Yeah, I think you've rightly made the right choice there.
I mean, I originally had this number one because you had the loudest moment ever. You know, the loudest decibel reading ever. And by the way, I mean, you know, we call the greatest, you know, we call the stadium the greatest setting, but we really should have called it the loudest setting. I mean, I know we can't do that anymore because it's not, but, you know, we should have done that, like,
totally,
you know, 15 or 20 years ago.
And, you know, the Mike Grant, when Tommy Smith came around the corner and just knocked the shit out of him, man, I believe that play. The neighbors called the cops on my dad.
Wait, so were you? So you weren't at the game?
I was not in attendance for this game. No.
Okay, so I was at the game.
You did have the cops come to the house? So there was that. Nice childhood memory.
Great moments in Cornell family history.
Yes.
I remember leading up to that game that the lead up was amazing. Like, it was just like the biggest fucking game. I remember at school, like,
that was massive.
There was a vice principal at our school, and I remember talking to him about it like multiple times that week. And I just remember people in the neighborhood were talking, they're like, "Oh, you guys are going to the game." And I remember, and we had seats like way the hell up, like the top third of the upper deck. And yeah, I mean, I couldn't believe that like the stadium was holding up. Because if you look at that decibel reading on that play, it's 133.6 was the reading. And I think somewhere that's like a little bit more than like when an airplane takes off.
Yeah, no, they compared it to the C-130. I think it was it Dr. Jackaroot on the sideline for that game?
Actually, no, it was Adrian Karsten who...
That's right, Adrian Karsten.
Who passed away by suicide later, not after the game, but... you know, the Mike Gottfried and Ron Franklin, who had just a smooth voice. He was the ESPN announcer at the time. And if you watch that video, like, you can just, at the beginning, like, you can just hear the crowd. And Franklin said that, like, they've been there for a couple hours. Like, they've been getting ready. And, yeah, it's just an amazing crowd, an amazing night. You know, defending national champions, loudest moment in college football history.
Yeah,
you know, no. Amazing win.
Amazing win. Kauffman had a great run. In that game,
Joe Kralik had a fake touchdown.
Yeah. Oh, geez. Yeah. That's
one that he didn't catch, but they called it a touchdown.
God, that was bad. That was really bad. Yeah. That was. But hey, you know, you get those on occasion.
Yeah. All right. So last one. I mean, we've alluded to this. The all I saw was purple game. So why don't you? So 1990 USC. Why don't you give me your thoughts on that, brother?
Well, I mean, obviously, it comes down to the Marinovic coach quote of, you know, "All I saw was purple." I mean, that is the epitome, right? That is always in the program of Husky, you know, the Husky programs. I mean, that is like, that kind of like stamps what that team represented, you know, the Ettman era. And the way they played the game, I mean, that just put everything in perspective of what that team was capable of that year and the potential ahead. All of those things, you know, were kind of wrapped up into that statement. And when you see that, you know exactly, you know, as a Husky fan, what that points to in Husky history. And it was just a complete domination of USC in that game.
Yeah. And the night before that game, they had a celebration, 100 years of Husky football. Because I think 1889 was the first year, or maybe it was 1890. But that was it. So it was a huge deal leading up to the game. And it's always beautiful, and it's a huge game, and you just come through with flying colors, and the crowd does as well. Yeah, so were you at that game?
No, I was not in attendance. No.
Yeah, so that's the first game I ever watched, the first Husky game I ever saw. You know, I was a little shit, 6 years old, watching on the floor, I think with my brother and my dad. And I just remember it was like 100 degrees that day. Or like 95, like it was like really hot. And it was just I just remember it was such a huge win at the time, but like it took me 2, 3, or 4 years to like actually realize how huge of a win it was.
Yeah, and again, I mean, it comes back to the history of college football and you know, what it meant to so many people.
Yeah, I mean,
it's in the area. I mean, in the region. I mean, Husky football was a really big deal.
Yeah, and just to go back for a second, people should watch the end of the second quarter, like the last couple minutes, and you could see the effect of the crowd. Like, it's just amazing. You would never see that in a game today.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how that compares to the safety from the 92 Nebraska. I don't, you know, Bill Simmons on his rewatchables, he has like an apex. He has all these categories that I have to do more research on. But I mean, what would you say is like the crowd apex moment? Was it the 1992 safety against Nebraska, or was it those last couple minutes of the first half against USC, where Todd Marinovich was like complaining to the refs that like he couldn't.
Yeah, they could hear. Yeah, I mean,
which one is the like apex moment? It's hard to say.
It really is. I mean, because the Ohio State game was the first night game at Husky Stadium too, right? There was a lot of hype around that too. I mean, there was just people we were able to drink all day. Which, by the way, there's an article that comes out, like, you can lower your risk of stroke and heart attack with moderate drinking. So for any of you that are just thinking about quitting drinking, you might consider otherwise.
Honestly, I have to, at times when I get stressed out and tension headaches and I have a little wine.
Yeah.
It makes it feel better. So, yeah, moderate is the key.
Yeah.
Moderation.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I mean, it speaks for itself, right? It's the number one home game of Husky history. It just sums it all up.
And under the new college football system, this shit would not be half as meaningful.
Totally.
You think anybody remembers like a... I mean, you think the New England Patriots, like, you think their fans like remember like, oh, well, we beat, you know, whoever... You know, 27-21 in the middle of the season. It was like the greatest win ever. Like, no.
Yeah, it was these huge marquee games in the conference. Every game meant something. You know, when you hear Tom James talk about when they prepare each week for a game, I mean, it was a big fucking deal. Week in, week out. You know, they only played, 11 games, right, at the time. Every game was really meaningful.
Yeah, I just hope maybe this year or next year, before college football completely changes, we can get, you know, we can have a game that's in the top five, if not in the top 10.
That would be outstanding.
I mean, Michigan last year would have been.
Yeah, that would have been great.
It would have been great, but.
Didn't happen, obviously.
Yeah.
Plans changed.
Do you remember watching the 1990 USC game?
Do I remember it?
Yeah.
I mean, I have fragments. I don't have, I don't have the entire game imprinted in my mind.
So I remember.
I have a lot of memory around the Iowa victory in the Rose Bowl. I remember being real fired up about that game, 46-34 victory.
Yeah, where we just destroyed them.
Yeah,
another game that was much worse than the score indicated.
Yeah, no, I kicked their ass, and I did want to add in. You know, we talked about it pre-pod, but the 2E 300-200, obviously the it was a marquee match. You know, Stanford was really good that year too. But that performance by Tui was just...
They were good in the conference, but the conference was shit.
Yeah, right.
I think that was the year, like, Stanford lost to, like, Texas by, like, 50.
Yeah. No, it was a down year for sure, right? But, I mean, in standard of conference, Stanford was technically, you know,
yeah,
good.
Yeah.
But their defense was horrific. I mean, clearly, I mean, Tui just dominated. It was unreal. Like, it was just... running down these huge, massive lanes, like no one around him on the field.
Didn't he break his ass?
Yeah, he broke his ass. He got a shot of cortisone at halftime. Yet apparently, his whole entire backside was just like dark purple and blue for weeks. Played through it all. I mean, Tui was just an animal. Him and Hobert, probably the biggest brass balls quarterbacks in history of the program. Those guys had brass balls.
Man. Yeah, we're going to do a rewatchables and talk about the 91 Nebraska game because I know you want to talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. But, just to quickly point out on that Tui game, though, I mean, truly, it was a sight to behold, like what he did that day. I mean, that is truly epic. I mean, 300 and 200? I mean, how do you do that in a game? One guy, 500 yards. I mean, that's an unbelievable feat.
And it still stands today.
Does it? Is it still stand?
I don't know. I was saying that as a statement or a question. I should have clarified. I guess yes. I mean, I don't. I think there's some guys, some quarterbacks who've rushed for over 200, but they haven't thrown for 300. Obviously, a lot of guys who've thrown for 300. And have rushed for 100, but yeah, that.
I mean, unbelievable.
Yeah, and then we lost to UCLA. They just couldn't. I mean, we just, you know, he just wasn't healthy enough to play the next week. So he barely could do anything, unfortunately.
Yeah, he could hardly walk. Yeah. No, he was tough as nails because he got hurt in the Purdue. He got hurt in the Rose Bowl too. Got hurt just before half.
Yeah. I thought he got hurt in the third quarter.
Was it third? No, you're right. It was.
And then Cody Pickett came in and threw a pass.
It was third quarter, and and he came back. Like, he was out for a bit, if I recall. Yeah, it was third quarter. But he came back. Yeah.
All right,
maybe
brother.
Near the end of the third. That's why I was thinking, like,
yeah,
there's a change in quarters. Anyway.
We should probably wrap this up.
Wrap it up.
Getting late.
Yeah, way
over time.
Long. Yeah. Well, hopefully people listen. Then it'd be worth it.
Yeah.
Hell, and if anyone wants to continue or pick up drinking again, don't buy Fremont Kraken Hazy IPA because you won't stop drinking it. Phenomenal beer. Don't buy it. Because you'll just end up buying more.
Yeah. Listen, yeah.
You've been warned.
Listen, people. This guy knows what he's talking about.
I do. All right. Good night.
All right, brother. Good night, everybody. We'll be back again soon. Go Dogs.
Go Dogs.